Street Smart Podcast, coming at you again from the Upright Digital Lounge Studio. Today we're sitting here talking with Scott Milleran. So, Scott, thank you again for being a part of it.
And thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, Scott, I met you on LinkedIn, just like I meet almost every single person. And it just so happened that you were also the father of Sarah here at Upright, Upright Digital. It's funny.
That's my claim to fame lately.
That's right. You get introduced as, you're Sarah's dad. And I have a similar experience. My younger brother played baseball my entire life and played some minor league ball. And they'll say, oh, you're Colby's brother. Yeah. And I'm like, no, he's my brother. So it's kind of an interesting thing.
But yeah, I've given up on that whole pitch, you know, Sarah's dad. But I'm proud of her and happy to be affiliated.
Is what your business card says now.
Yeah.
Sarah's dad.
A.K.A.
Yeah. So, Scott, again, this is just, you know, like you and I talked a bit yesterday, and it's just a conversation really to kind of understand who you are and how you got on the path to forming multiple businesses now. And you haven't always founded businesses. You also worked, in industry. So let's start there. Let's start with, you know, where are you from and that type of thing.
Sure. I grew up in central Illinois, in a college town where Illinois State is. My father was a professor there. And it was a great environment. You know, sports were a big deal. And I played all sports growing up until kind of junior high, and I focused on basketball. And that ended up being, I guess, what you'd call my ticket out of the Midwest. You know, sure. I wanted to see the world, do more things. And my childhood dream was to go play at UCLA, but I was too short, too slow for all that. But I did get recruited for basketball and ended up going to West Point, which was a great experience for me, because I have to say I didn't have a lot of military exposure growing up. And I went there, and it was just, you know, drinking out of the fire hose kind of scenario.
Right.
And ended up being a great situation to get a credible university, great education, and play Division I college basketball, which just takes you to a complete another level in understanding teams and roles and how that works. And so that really impacted my life really for the rest of my career. You know, components of that I still incorporate into what we do day to day and how I think about business and that sort of thing. So and once I went to the military academy, you graduate, you serve in the military, so you move around a lot.
Sure.
I got to live in Oklahoma, Georgia, Germany, and even spend some time overseas. And it was a great way to expand my horizons and kind of prepare me for what would ultimately lead me to the oil and gas business.
That's outstanding. So what did you want to be when you were a little boy?
I always thought I wanted to be like an inventor or a architect. You know, that just seemed so interesting to create and design and build stuff.
Right.
And I was constantly taking apart the old models and figuring out a way to like reconfigure things and run the little electric motors and stuff. And it just created my interest that really led me down the path of engineering.
Awesome.
And although I've never been a practicing engineer, you know, I just kind of had a creative mind as a kid and wanted to, you know, design and create products, which I've never done.
Right. Yeah. Well, you wanted to, though, and that's important.
That was what I started thinking about.
I always had a problem as a kid whenever I'd get something like that. I was the same way. I would like to take it apart.
Yeah.
And then I would try to put it back together, and I always had leftover parts.
Yep, yep. Yeah,
that's how you
get creative, right?
They have extra, and it still worked. So yeah. I was like, well, these were completely unnecessary parts.
Right.
Obviously. So you go to West Point, and Sarah and I were talking a little bit before, and she was talking about the graduation rate at West Point and people dropping out. And I have a curious question if you know the answer to it. If you drop out of West Point, do you then still have to serve in the military?
So the way that works, or the way it worked when I was there, I don't know how it is now. I think there's a different shifting theme on that. Mm-hmm. You know, you show up there and your whole class is in these auditoriums and they tell you, look left, look right. One of you won't be here at graduation. And it in fact played out to be the truth.
Wow.
In my situation. But we recently made a trip up there, and the philosophy's changed now, where it's not like only the tough survive kind of mentality. It's more like we have the best people that the country can offer, and we need to try to keep them here. So the attitude of the academy has shifted to more of a, you know, how do we get these people through the program rather than, you know, having a situation where people are dropping out. But lunch, like the first formation coming back as a junior is when you supposedly incur your commitment. So that lunch from your second year going into your third year is very important, because at that point in time, you know, they welcome you to the Army, because one way or the other, you're going to serve.
Sure,
if you graduate or not. And there are some people that have done that, but that's the trigger point. So everybody's kind of looking around. And ironically, I got to share a story about that. I was coming back my junior year traveling, and my flights were all messed up and delayed. And back then, you know, we didn't have cell phones or anything like that.
Right.
So there's no way to really reach out and say, hey, I'm stranded, I can't get there on time. And all my buddies are wondering what happened to me along the way, you know, and if I was going to come back. But it was really just a travel delay that was holding me
and
up.
They were like, I knew that guy was going to wash out.
What happened? He's gone.
When she mentioned that sort of that washout rate being as high as it was, I was like, I think they – what happens to their military commitment? So it's at the junior year
after
is what triggers
years,
that commitment.
Yeah.
I got you. Okay. Well, that makes sense.
Yeah.
So you get a couple years in.
Yeah, and then, you know – we had some guys that came in that just couldn't pass like plebe or freshman English. You know, they just struggled. It was a very tough course intentionally.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, some of my teammates didn't make it and left and went on to play elsewhere.
You know, it's an interesting point you bring up too. You know, getting into West Point is not an easy thing. You go through a lot of interview process and there's a lot of calling process that goes into that admission.
Mm-hmm.
So already the people that are there have gone through a tremendous amount of scrutiny to get there, and then you're intentionally trying to wash those people out. I think it's interesting to think about that sort of shift in mentality that, hey, we already have
right.
the best and brightest. Why are we trying to tear these people apart?
Right.
Well,
and there's an investment in these people, right?
Right.
So the government is effectively paying for to have these people there, and you put a 2-year investment in somebody and then they leave,
mm-hmm.
you know, you've kind of failed in your objectives. But I will also say too, though, at 18 years old, it's very hard to make that commitment of, you know, what's going to be 9 years of your future.
Sure.
You know, the 4 years at the academy and then the 5 years after. And, it's very daunting for an 18-year-old, because what's important at the time is you're looking around and your buddies are, you know, going to frat parties or doing whatever and having this great time.
Right.
And you're wearing uniforms and learning plebe knowledge and
marching
running around,
formation
and marching around, going to college, you know, and it's a very different, it's tough in the 18-year-old mind, but you know, where I sit today, I absolutely have zero regrets and glad we pushed through. And
everyone that I know that's ever gone to any of the academies, West Point or Air Force Academy or Naval Academy, they'll all look back on it and say, you know, that really sucked, but man, I would never trade at all anything for that.
Yep.
So you go to West Point, you graduate with what degree?
I graduated with an engineering degree. You could at the time either major or get a kind of a track type degree. Mm-hmm. And so mine was general engineering or bachelor of science, basically in engineering. And then I was, so your class rank kind of dictates where you, at least back then, I'm speaking 30 years removed, right? I don't know how it is today, but class rank dictates everything. So your initial pick is what branch of the Army you go into, artillery, infantry, armor, whatever segment of the armed forces or the Army. And then once you're branched, then you basically go into a big auditorium and the Army issues assignments, like how many slots they have at different posts, and you sit in rank order. And as they go through, you know, back, I don't know if you remember the overhead projectors they had. Well, they put up all the assignments on these overhead projectors, and as the first guy stands up and takes his pick, they crossing it off. And when it gets to you, you know, you got to have your options ready to go. I think you have 2 minutes or something to make your choice, and that's where you end up going.
man, kind of a pressure cooker, right?
Yeah,
out,
a little
right
bit.
Out of
yeah.
the gate, huh?
Well, and you know, I have to say, a lot of athletes ended up in the field artillery, so we were all in there, kind of, you know, juggling to find our assignments. And you know, there wasn't an internet to research the posts, so you kind of had to talk to people and figure it out. And where's a good place to go? And
you actually had to talk to people?
Yeah, yeah.
What was that like?
Well, the instructors were a big influence, right? So
sure.
They're all officers. So they can tell you their experiences and what's a good choice and what's not.
They try to influence you into whatever they were doing.
Oh, yeah.
Of
yeah,
course.
For sure. Yeah,
yeah, for sure.
Yeah, yeah.
So you end up in field artillery.
Yeah, which is cannons, basically.
Which is amazing.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun.
Yeah. Getting to launch projectiles, how far?
You shoot targets that you don't see, you know.
Yeah,
so
that's
you
awesome.
Got to rely on. So a portion, you know, you serve different roles, but you have a forward observer role where you're out with an assigned unit and you're calling in the fire on the targets.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're actually with the cannon battery is another segment of your service. So you're the one launching the projectiles, which, it was a lot of fun, and I enjoyed learning about it because there was a lot of math and science. We didn't have computers back then. We
right.
had to actually plot it out on a board and send the fire direction information out to the cannons. So, yeah, I did that for, you know, 4 or 5 years, and then went to Germany and ended up getting deployed with a cavalry unit to the first Gulf War. And everything got real, real fast, you know
oh,
what
yeah.
I mean? Yeah. So, we did a lot of things in the field that you probably should have been preparing for in advance, but, it was a great way to kind of cap off my military career and move on to the civilian world, as they say.
And no doubt all of that stuff has, like you said, you know, kind of formed the mentality into going into the different businesses that you worked in, plus the ones you founded and the like. So I'm sure that still influences decisions you make today.
Oh, for sure it does. And, you know, going back, I really got lucky with a lot of choices I made. I mean, I have to be honest, I wasn't as thorough as I probably, looking back, should have been. But, you know, I just luckily picked some things that were really great experiences that introduced me to great people along the way. And, you know, people and good resources really are the equation that wins no matter what business you're starting. And, you know, that value has just been threaded through everything that I've done through my career.
Yeah, you're exactly right. So you transition out of the military when?
91.
And from 91, you get out of the military. Did you know what you were going to go do, or did you have something lined up? You know, walk me through that transition process from military into civilian. Now I got to go do something.
Right, right. Well, I didn't know what I was going to do, but there was a military officer recruiting company that was very prominent at the time. It had somewhat of a selection component to it. They didn't just take everybody. So you meet and an interview with the owners of the recruiting firm, and then they ultimately lead you to a 4-day session at a hotel where the first 2 days you prep, you learn, you know, what to wear, how to answer interview questions, you know, clean up your resume and understand how to interview. And then the 2 days on the weekend, you literally bounce around room to room and interview with 12 to 15 different companies. And
these are actual interviews.
These are real. Yeah. So
practice,
2 days prep
interviews.
And then 2 days you're on.
Wow.
And, I interviewed with everything from Walmart distribution to PepsiCo to all these, they just give you all this variety of options. And I ultimately, interviewed with a drilling company, and that really caught my attention because I didn't really want to be caught in an office type environment. I wanted some mix of being an office environment as well as being in the field. And the drilling company really appealed to me, and there were a couple West Point grads that were there interviewing, and that's where I ended up going, first one out of the block.
So you head out of the military straight into the drilling world.
right into drilling and right into roughnecking. So
outstanding.
Yeah. So
less office, more field for
right.
You.
Right. 100% field.
So, right. Yeah.
Yeah. You go from captain, leader of men to worm's corner and making tongs bite, but, you know, invaluable. At the time, there were days you're like, what am I doing again? Why did I go down this path?
How did this happen?
Yeah. But ultimately, that was just, you know, you paid your dues. You kind of figured out the language of the business, and you met the people. And, you know, I roughnecked offshore California, southeast Oklahoma, and then south Texas, all in that period of time. And, you know, I was not a driller or anything, and at the time things were a little tight, so we had a lot of experienced guys that were tool pushers that were now running rigs, and you know, there was a lot of experience out on the rigs, and safety hadn't really caught on yet. You know, it was wear your hard hat, but
yeah, don't put your hand there.
Yeah Don't get hurt was a safety meeting,
right? That's right.
Yeah. So and you probably understand that very well in your profession, but so that was just, you know, looking back, it's experience I can share almost at every stage of my career in the oil and gas business. You know, there's some component there that matters. You can connect with somebody that thinks that, you know, engineers don't know what they're doing, or, you know, right, whatever role you're in. But that experience was difficult because I was really tired in a way that I hadn't been in a while. And but at the same time, I had a great appreciation for the people that go to the rigs every day, even to this day. You know, when it's snowing and rainy and it's at 3 a.m, there's someone on a rig somewhere making that rig work.
You know? Absolutely. And, you know, to your point, oil and gas is an interesting industry because people can sniff out if you know or don't know.
Right.
And for you to have the ability, you know, from your perspective now, to be able to say, hey, man, I've done that.
Right.
And I did that at a time that was even probably more challenging than now. That credibility is invaluable with those guys, for sure.
Yeah, I think it's great. And, you know, the guys I run into, a lot of them that are in some kind of role of leadership, they work summers, or their dad put them out on a rig, and or the summers between school, and that's how they paid their way through school. So
sure,
I have a great appreciation for the guys that are out in our country making oil affordable for our nation. You know, there's a lot of effort, commitment, sacrifices of these families to bring that home. And that does not fall on deaf ears or I think a general problem with our country and fossil fuels really centers around a lack of appreciation for what's really happening in the field.
Yeah, I don't think that gets discussed nearly enough.
No.
We get to hear about all of the awful things that happen or things that are perceived to happen. But
the oily duck problem, you know, that seems to be what we've been stamped with, and that is not the case. I would like to see our industry as a whole effort make a push to really educate the common person on what really goes on. And, you know, this sentiment towards fossil fuels right now is really aggravating for me, and I think a lot of people in the industry, because, you know, there's clean burning fuels, and it's integrated into many threads of life that the common person, and I'm referring to somebody that's never been in and around the business, they just don't understand. And I think if they did, there would be a completely different attitude. You know, even as far as thinking electricity just appears at the outlet, you know.
You just turn the light switch on. It's there.
Yeah. That's all you have to do.
That's all you got
to
do.
Yeah. And we could go into a whole discussion about that.
Yeah, no, that's a...
But, you know, it's... I just think as an industry, if there's a way, and that's part of the reason I like to get on the podcast, too, is that everything we can do to help our industry become more accepted as a primary commodity in the world, you know, we're not just talking about the U.S.
Oh, yeah.
But there's still people that don't have energy at their fingertips, and we still have a ways to go. We don't need to be fighting a battle on artificial makeup of that. It's not favorable to our country or the world, and that is aggravating to me.
to say the least. I think when you say it, you know, accepted, I think about it more in terms of truly understood. And then I think if they understood it, if there was a better understanding on what all it touched, I think the acceptance would be inherent in that.
Yeah.
I saw one of my favorite things I've seen recently was a post on LinkedIn. This guy had posted a picture of like a Tesla, and the license plate said like F oil or something on it, right? And the post was like, okay, so F oil. So I guess all of the plastic in that car needs to go away, and the road you're driving on needs to go away. And it was just this misunderstanding of, you know, oil isn't just gasoline, but you're right. There's a fundamental breakdown in general understanding of how important this resource is. So you get in there, you start roughnecking, and how long, what was the company?
It was Helmer & Payne.
Heard of them.
Going for it today. They're one of the, I think, leaders in drilling technology and in the field.
Yeah, absolutely. And so how long were you with H&P?
I was there 13 or 14 years, and, you know, that's a pretty big commitment. And enjoyed my time there. Like I said, met great people. But I just had an entrepreneurial itch that I couldn't get past, and I was looking for what's next. You know, like the concept, basically what consumes your mind is, all right, well, I'd just gone to grad school while I was working, and it was the internet boom. So it was the 90s. Mm-hmm. And people were getting funding for just having a good domain name, you know, and the sock puppets and stuff like that were getting, you know, $5 million, $10 million. And I was in California, and, you know, at the time, and it was just in your face all the time, like, what's the internet going to do? You know, where's the next move? And it was a very exciting time for technology. And I was thinking, well, maybe it's time to switch over. And ultimately, I was given an opportunity to bring technology into the drilling business, which was great. We created the global network and infrastructure around all the support services, maintenance, training, the education of the workforce, all the things that had kind of been overlooked. And I think there's still components of that that's being used there today. They've gone way past where we were, but that led to...
Was this at H&P?
That was at H&P. Okay. And then, but when I actually left, the opportunity was right under my nose. It was within an oil and gas company to start up a drilling division for them, Southwestern Energy, and it was kind of a baby step into entrepreneurship because I had the backing and the safety net of Southwestern, and they gave us a lot of latitude to try to go build and create this business, which we did. We put out 15 rigs in a year and hired 300 people, and it was a great exercise. It helped the company succeeded. I think only recently have they decided to get out of that, but we were in a really neat environment where they had acquired all this acreage in Arkansas underneath some phantom company names. Nobody really knew it was there. And we went into Arkansas and kind of saw it from the ground up, brought in the infrastructure, you know, contacted our network of people. Hey, we need supply companies here. We need this and that. And it was a really fun way. That year was just, I can say it was very fun. To call it work was almost not fair.
Sure. So you go back to something you said earlier. You said, you know, you had this entrepreneurial itch. Where do you think that came from? Were you around entrepreneurship as a in your formative years as a kid, or is that just something that you've always had? You know, where do you think that came from? The itch to be like, man, I can do this, and I need to.
I think it was really from my sports background. You know, you. This is not a dig on any corporation in any way, but there's points in your life where you get into a company and you sometimes can't see the direct impact on the business, and the you know, that the position you're in, whatever you're doing, is contributing, but you know, you're not sure exactly in what way. How does it impact the bottom line? And for me, I'd always, you know, had this is actually just enamored with the idea of owning your own business, which I didn't really know what I was thinking, but it sounded good, you know. Yeah, and
it sounds amazing.
And it seems, yeah, everybody thinks, oh, you own your own business. It's great. But I wanted to understand that, you know, peel the layer back and figure out what that was. I felt like I had more I could do. And so that really drove me to look around and ultimately find a way to do kind of a baby step. And once I did that, that led to more opportunities. And so it just started to snowball on, you know, what you can do. And you kind of get a playbook together. And, you know, it's never just one person. You find some people that you can rely on that come with you. And, you know, there's days you're in a room and you're looking at each other like, what are we going to do? How are we going to make this happen? And those are the fun days. You know, when I look back at the early days of Ranger Energy Services, we were in rental space that was mauve carpeting. It just wasn't really, you know, bought some secondhand furniture, and there was myself and Mikey Hopkins and a couple other guys in there. And we had been planning this and thinking about it, but then the day comes where it's time to go, you know, and you got to start making things happen. And that's where it gets really a little daunting at first, but once you engage, then it's just never a dull moment. And
so when you say you baby stepped in with Southwest Energy, were you an employee of Southwest Energy, and then they gave you sort of this, here's your budget, we need you to stand this separate business line up, so you were able to kind of scratch that entrepreneur itch with the backing of a larger organization, right?
That's exactly the right way to capture it. We had, I think the budget was around $150 million, which is very hard to go out and raise.
Sure, yeah.
But
it's nice they had it.
Yeah. And so we were employees. We were in a separate company. It was called DeSoto Drilling. And it was wholly owned by Southwestern. We did nothing but service Southwestern's needs, and they had nearly 1 million acres accrued and needed to execute a program that was basically put out to the investors. So there was a public company fulfillment obligation we had to meet, and timing was important. So there's pressure of timing, and you know, we got in, and some of the rig designs and things needed to be modified for what our experiences were, and you know, that costs a little time, and I know that there was some stressful moments in there, but ultimately the rigs got out. It was a successful program, and it was great to be doing that, because, you know, we didn't have to worry too much about payroll or the things that a lot of entrepreneurs lose sleep over, including myself. But that was, when I say baby step, that was probably good training wheels and a great way to get out there and do a startup.
And so from that point, you get that stood up, it's successful. Do you then say, okay, I'm going to do this for real, or do you do something else after that?
Well, it led to conversations. So we're in Arkansas, and there's, you know, Arkansas, Northwest Arkansas has the Walmart families, Tyson and J.B. Hunt. And J.B. Hunt wanted to get into the oil and gas business. And without boring you with all the details, I got introduced to him. He was interested in doing a drilling company. And so we kind of took that opportunity, or at least I did, to step out and create a drilling company with his backing. Unfortunately, he passed away before we got our first rig built and out on the market. But we had a business model that we executed, and it has had his name on it, which was one of only two companies that did. He had his trucking business and his drilling company.
Right.
So that was kind of neat. But that was a 5 or 6 rig company, and then that led to another opportunity to step out, go raise money, and do another kind of similar business model, 5 or 6 rigs. And this was at a time when West Texas was not too interested in having new rigs show up.
Sure. Well, so what time frame is this year?
This is, let's see, give me a second to do the math, like mid-2000s. 06, 2008, 07, yeah, somewhere in there. Yeah.
Yeah. Real fun time.
Yeah. Oil and gas. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Well, it was interesting because there was a time when there was new assets being built that hadn't been done in a long time, especially rigs. And then it was also a time when we were on top of the world and overnight no one was there, right?
Right.
So all through that, we're trying to do deals and raise money. And literally, energy was very popular at the time. And then with the housing crash that occurred, people we were talking to were no longer there. Overnight, no longer employed, and so deals that we had in process just went away, literally. Yeah,
went
overnight.
Back to start.
Yeah, just redo. And so it was, you know, I can go back and look at things, and there, it's one thing to be good, but it's okay to not be as good as you could be if your timing is good.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Timing is incredibly important. You know, I've seen values, yes, of the businesses go from, you know, $80 million down to $2 million without changing anything they were doing. But it was just the market and the environment that changed around it. It's just crazy how that works. But great learning. Probably missed some opportunities to make some money in there. But, you know, don't underestimate the value of timing.
Yeah, absolutely. So at this point, is this your first time to be out fundraising yourself?
This is the first time we've gone out without outside funding.
Yeah.
So Rally Point is our own friends and family backed business. And, you know, we've done, or I say we, because it's not always just me, but I've done businesses that were private equity backed and, you know, mixed results, mixed outcome. But Ranger was the one that most people are aware of because it went public, and it was a really great 3 or 4 year run on literally, like I was saying, starting with nothing, your team sitting in a room, you've got some capital, and it's at a time when you couldn't buy a new well service rig. You had to get in line.
Sure.
You know, and so there's just all these different, and again, the timing thing comes into play too. It's like on assets as well. And recently, you know, you just look at an example of how timing really affects things. You look at frac pumps and the evolution they've been through in the last five years that have made the previous version obsolete overnight, and values fluctuate between, you know, $1.5 million a pump to $150,000 a pump and back up. I think that illustrates perfectly the challenges of our industry in a very short time frame, how an asset can change in value, and depending on where you get in and where you start to buy in, impacts, you know, what your return is going to be on your capital invested
and how quickly that return is realized.
Exactly.
Too.
Yeah, it affects timing. It affects every component of what you're doing.
When you think about the timing aspect of it, what do you do in your business to identify when that timing, when you believe that timing is the right time?
Well, we all try to catch it on the way up.
Of course.
Right. And you have to go. If we had a crystal ball, we'd all been rich and retired a long time ago.
Sure.
But, you know, outside factors influence our business, and they're unpredictable, and it's hard to see 6 months, 12 months in the future. But you just, at the time, you try to find a point at which there's a need for the service that you want to create. Can you implement technology that will differentiate you from your competition, or can you do something in a slightly different way that gives you an advantage in the market? And then you execute and you do the best you can. And in hindsight, you know, we missed timing. You know, we didn't guess it right. And then there's other times that you just, you know, you get it right, and then you hope that the industry will support your business for a period of time, and then you decide, you know, is there a point at which you exit, or do you keep running the business? And you know, I think you always have to build the business with the idea of being a value creator, and then if something comes along the way that gives you an opportunity to exit, you take it. But you never need to create a business with the thought of exiting, because it just creates a different culture, a different mindset. People don't really engage in the business. And that, I think, is for some entrepreneurs, you know, is a shortfall on their part. Is, you know, you can't go out there. Everybody knows, well, oh, they're just building it to sell in 3 years, you know.
Sure.
And then we'll be part of another company. And, you know, as much as that's been effective and ultimately builds great businesses, there's a point at which you lose good people in that process. They choose to go on and do something else. And that's the downside of what's going on with that.
So when did you found Ranger?
Ranger, we started in 2014, and we had a private equity-backed investment, and we were going to put out new rigs. We had a contract with a large operator in the Eagle Ford that kind of helped back that or get us started with that business. And we built Ranger over the course of that period of time. So 2014, we start, oil's, you know, over $100 a barrel.
That was great.
Our second new rig from National Oil Well, they asked to put in the show in West Texas. And we agreed to that. It was great. It was great marketing. And we chose to go out there one day and visit the show and see our rig. And on that day, oil dropped $40 a barrel. It went from like 120 to 80.
Speak of timing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, the buzz around the show is like, oh, you see what oil prices are. And they were like, no, we're still good. Everything's good.
Yeah.
Well, we all know what happened going into 2015.
Things yes.
got incredibly lean. And we managed to, navigate our way through that and come out on the other side, largely with a great customer relationship. And then, just guys in the business that were just head down and keep pushing forward. And there's no other magic formula than that. It was like, we were not going to accept that as our failure. There's always work out there. We got to go find it. And things slowed up a little bit, but you know, it picked up shortly thereafter. So it was a very interesting time to be a new business. And again, you talk about timing.
Yeah.
We had no way to predict what was going to happen.
No one did. I know the company I was working for at the time, I'd gotten out of the oil and gas services business, ended up on the EMP side, which was awesome. I always wanted to make that change just to see the other side of the thing.
It's a good side.
It's a good side. It's a different side. It's a different mentality. And it was in Fort Worth, and we'd done a big deal with an operator down in the Madisonville area. And, I mean, it was a huge deal. We financed some debt and stuff into it as well. And then 2015 happened. And then there was a biblical flood in that area right. at the same time. And there was a whole bunch of things that went against us. And ultimately, I always tell people, if you stay in oil and gas long enough, you get caught up in a layoff. And ultimately I was. But you're right. 2015, 2014 was fantastic. 2015 was a weird time. And then here we are still on the other side of it, and we're still doing it. But
so the cycles seem quicker now and more extreme now.
Yeah, more drastic.
Like minus $37 a barrel. Bad.
Yeah, it was out. It was that got to the point of watching that day, and just you just kind of start laughing. You're just like, well, now what? Like,
yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Well, what I've learned is when things are bad, it triggers how can I get into this? This is the time to invest, right?
Sure.
And that is a very difficult if mentality you as you see things crashing. But that's where that's your go time as an entrepreneur. When things are bad, start thinking about how you get in, you know, because they will come back.
That's right. And if you get in then, you know, to your point with a timing, that is some timing you can predict in terms of accessibility to things, right? So when times are bad, you have equipment's more accessible, people are more accessible, you know, those types of things. And also you can be a bit more choosy in those times. So I think that's a great point. But so you come out of 2015.
Yeah, we've been all over the map here.
We're moving.
But that's good.
It's a good conversation, right? So 2015 is an odd year. We come out of that fairly quickly. Ranger goes through, like you said, in large part to great customer relations, which can't be understated.
Right.
And then, you know, the people aspect. People just put their head down and go to work, and we'll figure this out.
Yeah, we had – there was one day I distinctly remember Mikey, who started Ranger with me, come in, and he closed the door, and he was like, what are we going to do? You know, and that was the moment at which we're like, we're just going to fly into the eye of the hurricane and see what we do.
Just
come
lean
out
into
on the
it,
other
yeah.
side. Yeah, because we can't give up. But you have moments like that.
Sure.
You know, as an entrepreneur, whether it's you know, private equity backed or you're on your own or whatever, you don't want to fail. And, you know, I think that there's multiple levels you can end up with failure. And, you know, you try to avoid the worst scenario on that. And, you know, everybody's got a personal pride and obligation in their commitments. So, and that's what's neat, too, is a smaller business. Everyone is got their hands on the rope and you're pulling and you know pretty much what's happening with the business. And
sure.
I think that's important. And you lose that as you grow. Unfortunately, there's a level you get to that you lose the personal touch because of your size and your growth. And that's what I've kind of figured out is where I think that's appropriate timing for someone else to lead and run the business, you know, if I create it, that, because I do appreciate every aspect of it. I like the field side of it. I like knowing our customers. You know, I love going out to visit a rig site, well mm-hmm. site where the guys are. And, you know, that personal touch, you just get, as you grow, you know, a layer and a layer continues to remove you from that because you have different obligations. And, you know, as I've gotten older, I think that, from my perspective, that's the point at which, you know, I like to have that component in the business, and it kind of helps me see the scoreboard, if mm. that makes sense. And the point at which you're not sure what your contribution is, that's you know, for someone else to manage and run. And
you know, interesting, when you said when I asked you what you wanted to be when you were a little boy, you said an inventor, creator, that kind
yeah.
of thing. And that's really what you are, right? You're creating
some
these
degree,
businesses
yeah.
and then at some point where it gets the creation kind of gets to the point where you can't see all of the touch points. You're not bored with it, but you're like, this, I'm better suited to go create a new thing, right?
Yeah, and you know, you read about that a lot when you look at guys and they step out at certain points. And I don't want to be cliche, but it's all in your personal makeup. Like, at what point can you transition? And you know, I think that everybody, a leader, is capable of running a small business and a bigger business. You know, I think if you can run a small business, you can definitely run a bigger business. You know, it just becomes a personal preference at, like, what level do you want to be able to interact? And especially in the public market, it changes the equation completely. There's a whole group of people that have to meet compliance requirements and, you know, you just don't have that in a smaller company.
Sure.
You try to always run a business to meet that kind of thing, but you don't have extra staff around to, you know, meet Sarbanes-Oxley requirements and stuff
right.
like
so
that.
Right. So when you founded Ranger, did was the idea always to go public with it, or did that just sort of evolve along the way? And as that evolved, how did you arrive at that decision?
That's a good question. It was opportunistic. So we did not sit down and strategize an IPO. But you also have to be ready to execute at the time at which the opportunity presents itself. So we're a couple years into it. We had fielded 17 rigs, I think, at that point in time. And oilfield services, for a large part, has not been in favor in the investment community, financial community, and we see that today as well. But there was a very narrow window in that time frame where oilfield service businesses were getting recognition and they were getting valued at a fair market value for an exit, which would be a public offering.
Mm-hmm.
And the private equity group saw that. We were not big enough on our own to do that, but we had another company that we had competed with that was literally doing the same thing we were doing, and they merged us together, so we were of the appropriate size.
Mm-hmm.
and took it out to the market.
Still
and
retained Ranger. Ranger basically just absorbed.
And there were was another, what I would call a comparable size, maybe even a little bit bigger than us, company that came in. And then there were some assets pulled in from another smaller, similar business. And we took that to the market, and there was interest to take it out, and we were able to go public. But again, you know, it was opportunistic. We, at that point in time, we were still mentally building our business. We were looking at, you know, adding more rigs and, you know, how do we grow? And then all of a sudden, times changed, opportunity was there, and we went for it. And, you know, it was, in hindsight, I would say that I wish we could have continued running the business. But you don't always get to control the outcome.
Sure.
So you roll with it and do the best you can.
Was the IPO the decision? Was the introduction to the idea of doing the public offering, was that initiated by the private equity group, or was that initiated between all of you guys? Was it kind of like the private equity group saying, "Hey, we need to do this"?
Yeah, that was the driver. I mean, they had controlling interest in the company.
Sure.
And you kind of go along with it.
Yeah, you go, okay, yeah, yeah. That sounds great.
Yeah, so you shift gears and figure out how you do that.
So you go through the IPO, which I'm sure was eye-opening, that whole process.
It was.
And learn a ton. So you get through that, and at that point, is that when you exit Ranger?
Yeah, so I stayed with them through the S-1 process, which is really, you know, you spend a lot of time in a big conference room writing about your business, and then I exited at that point. But, you know, I got to see behind the curtain at Oz, right? We got to go stand on the balcony, ring the bell.
Which is cool.
It was
very
cool.
I mean, let's be real honest.
Yeah,
that's very cool.
I won't deny that at all. But it was bittersweet for me because at that point in time, I knew things were changing, and it was going to be time to go. So, just to see behind, you know, like I said, the curtain at Oz, it's really neat. But, you know, for some people, it's just hard to keep everyone happy when you bring a bunch of companies together like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I saw some people that probably didn't get the recognition they should have gotten in that process, and that was hard to.
It's interesting when companies come together, especially if they were rivals. So I worked for Neighbors Well Services,
yeah.
And they were pool company back in the day,
right?
And when I got there, it was Neighbors, and so you still had guys in the office that only wore pool stuff,
right?
And I still remember the day that Neighbors came down and said, "Okay, guys, all that's fine and well,
right?
We get that you're proud of that, you're Neighbors, so knock that off." And
yeah.
You would have thought that they walked in and slapped someone's mom at Thanksgiving. Like, it was crazy, the response to that. It was so. Just, and to me, that had no stake in it, I thought, well, that's ridiculous. But also, I get it, right? It was just a really interesting time.
That is an incredible example of the what I think is the biggest challenge of integration, is to find the new culture that everyone can buy into. Usually, you know, I've always heard there's no such thing as a merger.
Mm-hmm.
One company is
somebody's the
dominant.
Yeah.
So, but that is the challenge. I mean, for anybody that's a leader in an acquisition, it's to merge that mindset into something. And I would say oftentimes it's not done very well. And it ends up being a mandate, like you said, come
right.
down. It's like, all right, guys, there's no meetings around it or anything.
Yeah, it's saying, literally an edict. Like,
right.
Take those museum pieces.
Yeah,
and
you don't
put
like
on
it,
the
you
new
can
stuff.
Leave.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
So,
it is almost that stern, but it and you're right. And it's the challenge too is how do you get to some sort of a consensus culture without losing the primary, you know, core drive
yeah,
that's there, right?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, it's an interesting thing, and. You know, at the time you guys are trying to go public, did you say you merged two companies,
three
in
yeah.
with?
So you had three leadership groups coming together. You
right.
had, you know, all the different assets and the different yards, and it was, it was challenging times. That's probably the most difficult thing is to get that sorted out.
When you look back on that now, would you say it went about as good as could be expected, or there, man, we could do that way better? Yeah, okay, fair enough.
I think where we look at it today, it all turned out just fine.
It turned out okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But there were some learnings along the way. So
that's good.
Yeah. I think it was good.
That is good. Yeah. So you're out of Ranger now and you're like, man, I'm done playing golf and fishing.
No, I didn't think that. I, as crazy as it is, I love what I do. I love the business. I want to stay involved to the point at which I'm just not able to add value, I guess. So I've kind of committed to that in my mind because I did have some time off. And in those periods of time, I don't have any hobbies. And even if, like, I'm not a golfer or a hunter, I don't mind fishing. But
yeah.
And even the guys that I know are golfers or hunters, they're like, there's only so much of that you can do.
That's right.
You know, you got to keep engaged.
Because all of your other friends have jobs.
Yeah, right, right. So that period of time for me was like, okay, I think what I like to do is have the challenge of running a business, whether that's advising, helping younger guys build their businesses or in whatever way possible. I just realized that that's really my hobby. That's what I like to do. So you look for ways to engage and do some fun things. And I can say I've got a couple of friends who are younger that are leading businesses now, and it's really fun to see them in their roles that they're in and be able to talk to them about, you know, just little things, even if it's like, hey, who can I call for this? Or, you know, those kind of things are really fun to see the guys you've worked with that you know stepping up and succeeding. So
Do you see at times when you're watching what they're doing, like, your fingerprints on sort of some of those decisions? And
no, I wouldn't say that. I think it's just, it's more of like a mutual respect for each other, you know, I think, than trying to see your influence on it. I think it's just, everybody's going to do it their way. But there are some things that you want to, like, when you see, there's a great example of, you know, like some leadership training, you know, some guys that grow up on the rigs and, you know, just kind of figure things out that are naturally born with good leadership skills. Then when you expose them to a training opportunity and they get even better and they realize, man, they embrace it rather than fight it, and they know it makes them better. Those are the kind of things that are neat to watch, because then they carry it on and then they're training their people. And something like that is neat for me to see, that there was something we did that was good enough that they adopted the practice,
you sure know?
And that's probably the best way to describe an influence or a change. But ultimately, they're the leader, they're going to drive the direction. And you know, it's great to see them have fun with growing a business.
I'd be willing to bet if I ask one of them, they would say that they would be able to identify the influence you've had.
Well, I don't know, you would have to ask them.
I bet they would.
I would be scared to hear some of the answers.
It is sort of a Pandora's box when you ask a question bit. Like that.
Be careful what you ask.
Yeah, I one time asked some people that I led, you know, we weren't working together at that point, and I was transitioning into another leadership role, and I remember texting and asking, what are some things that I did well? What are some things I didn't do well as your manager? And they had far more didn't do wells in there than did wells. And I was like, hey, man, let's lay one for one if you can, you know. But
good for you for asking that question, because those are the conversations that don't happen often enough in business, you know. If you really want to get better, ask your boss or even people that you work with, what's this look like? You know, one of the guys I had talked to I actually met him through a property exchange, but I was talking to him and he's like, do a 360 review. Don't ask just your boss, but ask the people that report to you and have them take a survey. And he said, you'll be really interested in how that comes out. And it's basically a question of, you know, what do you do well and what could you do better?
Sure.
And when you listen to the people that you work with or that report to you, what they have to say. It's not always what maybe your boss thinks, and that's a great way to, I think, develop yourself individually as you go through your career. And you know, be humble, ask the hard questions, and then don't be upset with the answer. Figure out, well, how can I change to sure. fix this? You know.
Yeah, and it's very impactful if the people that you ask that question to then actually see a modified behavior on the other side of that, because they realize you took that question seriously, and you're actually looking at it from a developmental perspective, not a, I can't believe that guy said that about
yeah, right,
me.
Right.
Look at the thing, right?
Well, and don't underestimate the value of honesty, right?
Sure.
So many workers love the feedback. Like, if you're talking to somebody and they're like, well, how am I doing? And you tell them a couple things that are, because you know.
Yeah.
You just maybe haven't had the opportunity to talk about it. And you share that with them. Many times, they're like, wow, I had no idea I was missing that. I'll work on it. I'll do better, you know. And I think that is the missing link in just a lot of management development kind of things, is having honest conversations. Because mm-hmm. it may be hard to say that to somebody's face, but if you do it in a professional way and it's legitimately observation, people will adjust and accommodate and try to get better.
Yeah, and also it allows that person to realize that you are noticing them. You do know what they're doing and how they're doing, and
right.
and those types of things. I do think that's very important. So now you didn't stop. So what did you do after Ranger?
We had a pump company that was like a miscellaneous pumping services, pump down and, you know, defensive frac type pumping. And that was just poorly timed, because we were buying frac pumps at the peak of the market, and that was not the best timing.
Well, unless you were the one selling the pumps.
Well, that's very true.
Yeah.
But we were buying, so
yeah, their timing was awesome. Yeah.
But I can say that although we stepped aside from that business, you know, the assets have gone on, and they're actively in that type of business with someone that was involved with the company at the time. And so it's gone on, and it's, those pumps are actively in use today. And it was a learning experience for me, because you know, it's, in my career, there's silos in the service industry. Mm-hmm. And you know, whether you're in drilling, production, completion, you kind of end up working a career in that silo, whatever
sure.
that is. And you know, I've been able to work in each one of those silos, so I feel like I have a very broad understanding of all the different service lines that are out in the oil field and the role they play, which has been fun. But you know, it also makes it hard to leverage your network, because they're all very different. You know, mm-hmm. the production engineer usually doesn't communicate with the completions guy, so you right. got to navigate your way through that. But so we did the pumping company for a short period of time, and then I worked with a scanning and testing business that was a merger, and we took that to market. It ultimately sold back to the owners, but in that timeline, the business, I really liked that business, and I thought there was room to add a layer of technology to a small ticket item. So that's where Rally Point came from. It was kind of a COVID opportunity to start something. And, you know, that I underestimated the challenges of the impact of that in starting a new business. You know, people just weren't accessible.
The impact of COVID, the restrictions
yeah,
associated
the restrictions
with that.
And, yes. You know, and if they didn't want to see you, it's like, oh, COVID, you know, you can't come in.
We just talked about that the other day on one of the interviews, that it gave a real, real convenient way
excuse,
to not
yeah.
have to meet
like
with
they
you.
Need another one, right?
Right. Well, they'll just not meet with you.
Right.
But at the same time, man, that gave them a, yeah, I can't, you know,
right.
guys, sorry.
So but, that I underestimated that challenge, but you know, we're moving along, and we have really high expectations for this year, and hoping to grow some more and do some good things.
I noticed a theme in the naming of your companies.
There is, yeah. I'm running out though.
Yeah, well, Rally Point's a good one.
I like it. Yeah.
Ranger's the best one.
Yeah. We try to, so for a period of time, we were doing the same color schemes and using a military name. But after Ranger, I decided we need time to change some colors. But so we don't do black and gold anymore, but still try to find a good military name.
There's nothing wrong with that.
No.
I'm sure you come up with something new.
Well, and Rally Point is, you know, a place where the unit gathers, resupplies, and gets ready to go forward on their next mission. So it seemed very appropriate in the timing of where I was and what we were getting ready to do.
So there's way more thought into that than I realized. And not just like, oh, we got to find something military and that one.
Yeah, we need a cool name.
But, yeah. No, Rally Point's a great name. It's interesting how many entrepreneurs I've talked to that even if they had businesses before, but many had their very first, like, effort in entrepreneurial space was during COVID. And I really think it had to do with a lot of people had a lot of idle time on their hands and just thought, man, I think I can maybe figure this out.
Right.
And I had one of my buddies actually talking about the you know, the labor force not coming back as strong.
Right.
And he was saying that he believes what happened is a lot of people started doing like side hustle type stuff and realized, oh, I don't have to go back to work necessarily, right? And so it's kind of an interesting
I guarantee thought. That was one component. I think the other was the environment we inherited. So logistics all of a sudden became really important. So a roughneck could get a CDL and go make $120,000 a year driving a truck.
Right.
And they're home more often, and you know, being in a truck is sure a lot more comfortable than being in the rain or snow.
Most of the time.
And so,
yeah.
Most of the time.
Yeah.
Unless you're in Houston traffic, I guess. Well, but I think we saw guys that could go find a better living and they left. And
you know, do so relatively easily. Just with a couple of tweaks here or there, we're on the way.
And the money became competitive. So I think that's a big labor challenge for us today is that as oil field service companies, the money's not the biggest attraction anymore for these guys. I mean, they're over the years, many guys went to the oil field because they could make a lot more money there.
Right.
And we don't have that differentiation anymore. And that's going to be a problem for us as we go forward. We got to figure out how to differentiate a tough manual labor job to the labor market to continue to attract people to come work here, because I think the gap there has narrowed to the point that we don't just get people that'll do it to make extra money. And that's concerning on a go-forward basis, I think, for the industry. The other thing, while I'm on that topic, is that I'm worried about is there isn't a lot of money available for oil field services. So companies are being asked to maximize equipment, you know, push their labor force and run hard. And I don't see the private equity groups have narrowed and gone away. There's only a handful left. The banks aren't doing anything into oil field services. And so you're seeing family office and smaller shops come around, but there's only so much they can do. And I think in 2 to 3 years, we're going to see a big demand for an investment in the service businesses that are out that have been running their equipment super hard and had to go through these peaks and valleys of COVID. And, you know, PPP probably helped to some degree. But,
for a period of time.
But that's over.
Yeah.
And so my short-term outlook is a real concern on capital for the oilfield service businesses. And then underneath that is, you know, the labor. How do you attract good labor for the future?
Yeah, and in that order, too. I mean, because if you don't have capital, even if labor's available, I mean, you can't do anything with that anyway.
Right.
So what do you what do you foresee or what are you planning? Like when you look at that and you see that you've identified that as a potential challenge, how are you preparing to address that challenge?
Well, for me, I think you have to look at your business and your cash flow and how you're going to use the money that you have. And if you can reinvest in your business, that's clearly the best way to go. But if you get approached with a customer that says, hey, in my case, I need 10 more trucks and you guys can have all of our business, you know, I think that at that point you have to maybe turn to the customers, the operators, to make an investment in your business to help you get down the path. Because I don't think you can go to a bank with a contract anymore and get the funding. So it's going to be a real challenge. And sure. I don't know that I have an answer. You know, I think you'll probably see some continued merger acquisitions of businesses. And as these businesses evolve, and I always look at the frac business because it's moving so fast. Mm-hmm. It was 2250 pumps, and it was 2500 pumps, and then it's tier four engines, and now it's electric. Mm-hmm. And that is a huge demand on capital. And I think it started to fracture the offering in the market, you know, as to what there's different price points for different type of frac fleets that exist. But in a nutshell, you know, we saw that with rigs, we saw that with drilling rigs and well service rigs to a certain degree. It just didn't happen as fast. But if you want to see that in a short period of time, you just look at what's happened with frac. And all of those changes require capital. And, you know, I don't know in the near term where that comes from if you have to make a complete fleet swap or upgrade or a large investment to go forward. I'm not sure where that comes from, but we'll figure it out because we always do.
We always do.
And I think money will ultimately come back to the market. I don't know in what form it will, and there's a couple good firms out there that are doing good things right now, but it's very compartmentalized and it's not huge money.
I mean, I think it's interesting you bring up the concept of if your customer comes to you and says, build out 10 more trucks and you can have all of our work, saying, that's great. Can we get some sort of a financial commitment on that? And I think that's just a fundamental change in sort of the way it's always been done is, okay, and we'll figure out if our business is right to do that or not, and we do it. Mm-hmm. And I've seen some of that already in, you know, like drilling companies in particular, not just, you know, once you pickle a rig, it's not easy to bring that thing back to go, right?
Right.
And in the past, it has seemed that when oil prices started coming back up, preemptively you would start seeing these rigs getting prepped to go back out, right? And instead, this time, it seemed like they sort of, let's just wait for a minute see what demand. And now it's sort of the customers are making adjustments as well, saying, okay, we know if we ask for a rig now, it's going to take X time for it to get prepped. I think you'll see some concessions like that, but I could see a place where there could be some upfront funding, you know, in association with a contract in place maybe. But but you're right. There's going to be a way that we figure it out. And honestly, it's going to take, I think, a change in, not to go down this path too far, but a change in political climate and going back to the initial conversation, a real understanding of how our industry impacts everyday people.
Right.
And if it goes away, what that looks like for you.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's a there's a pendulum in the business where over time, E&P businesses have decided that instead of having a contractor, that they would own the business. Mm-hmm. And I think in almost every case, it's not worked out for the long term. Mm. They're distinctly different businesses, and there's a reason there's a service component and a, you know, an E&P component that survive and live in oil and gas. And you know, what we don't want to do is go back and relearn the lessons that we've already learned from 10 years ago or 15 years
maybe
ago.
Sometimes a couple of times we've learned
that lesson. Yeah, we're terrible about that kind of thing.
A bit of a slow learner over here. Yeah.
But you know, what I will say is there's a lot of creative people in the business that figure out ways to get things done. And there will be new ideas that surface, new concepts, but I have seen a little more fiscal discipline, it seems like, and that's to your point that
sure,
we're not just going to, you know, willy-nilly throw stuff back in the market as fast as we can because rates are up. They go up and they come down, and they come down and stay down a lot longer than they seem to go up.
It feels like it anyway.
Yeah,
for
at
sure.
Least from the service side, you know, we'll play that. But I think that tension is something as an industry we need to address, because, you know, the rates impact the investment in the business. And, you know, as we're talking about, where does the money come from? Well, part of it comes from, you know, having a margin that allows you to reinvest in your own business. And there's a lot of times where you do the math and you can't quite understand, you know, where the extra money is going to come from. So instead of having peak and valley type situations, I think there needs to be conversations around the band in the middle of, you know, what's reasonable for a increase and what's reasonable for a decrease, mm-hmm. and how long that lasts.
And that would be pretty much any business. You'd want to be able to find a way to sort of hit that sweet spot in margin where you can reinvest in the business to grow the business so that you're less dependent on outside funding, or and you are prepared for those times that you can, you know, capitalize on an opportunity or sort of keep your powder dry until things get better.
Yeah, the challenge we have is the cyclicality of our
right.
business. You know, a lot of businesses you can forecast what's coming or foresee a few years out. But, you know, recently gas prices have dropped, and that changed the budget for 2023.
Sure.
It was different in November than it is today. And so we have this external pricing environment of a commodity that makes it more challenging to do the things that you just mentioned. You
yeah. know?
And that's what I think makes our industry challenging. I don't think we can ever control that because it's a global force. But, you know, I think if there's a better cooperation between the people that are making the money and the people providing services, that there's a better way forward.
It's interesting you mentioned that it kind of ebbs and flows. It seems like these the E&P company figuring out, like, now we're just going to buy our own well servicing rigs and,
right.
and do that. And that happened to us when I was at Neighbors. I'm not going to mention the customer, but it was literally we 1 yard serviced one customer, like, and it had a bunch of rigs out for that customer,
right.
and we leave on Friday and everything's fantastic. We show back up on Monday and they'd gotten a phone call that said, hey, we bought a bunch of rigs, we're gonna do it ourselves
yeah.
now and all yours are coming home. And and there have been others that do that, and I've always wanted to be a part of that conversation just to see just how sure of yourself you'd have to be to pull that off, and then realizing you're getting so far out of your core competency that it's going to be very difficult. That's a whole different thing.
Well, from my experience, you know, we as an industry of services, turnover's high.
Yes.
We have a lot of people that'll come and go, and when wages are good, you know, they'll jump company to company. Right or wrong, I mean, that's the environment we deal with. But
and we're used to dealing with
and,
it.
And we are. And we brought that into an E&P environment, and they started to see the turnover, and HR was absolutely beside themselves because, you know, they're hiring, you know, pretty much for a large part younger professionals,
sure.
college graduates. Don't move like that. And our turnover rate was half of what the industry rate was, but it was still like replacing, you know, 70% of the workforce every
yeah,
year.
And a lot of times, especially well servicing, you lose a guy, you lost an entire crew because they might
Very
be all
true.
Related. I mean, it was crazy.
So I saw that firsthand. The you know, just the environment in which the way the businesses operate, you have to have a really good understanding or a really open mind to understand. Which I can say my experience was a good experience, but there's little things that are nuances to each mm-hmm. side that when you blend them together, it's not the same.
Yeah, they don't play well together sometimes.
No,
for
no,
sure.
It's very difficult.
So you have Rally Point up and running, started in in the COVID years, and it's going great.
Yeah, we basically are an inspection service for the well sites as they're pulling production tubing. We have an electromagnetic box that scans the pipe coming out and grades it and gives our customer the chance to replace it before they run it back in. And then as you run the pipe back in, we have a hydrotesting unit that is a mid-sized truck that has a you know, a tank and pump on it, and we use water to pressure test the connections and the tubing, because there's things you can't always see on the way out. So ideally, you know, I look at it as an inexpensive insurance policy that can save our customers money. If you find a hole or a crack that they didn't see and they were running that back in the well, it costs them another workover to fix that.
Yeah, or you end up with, you know, parted tubing down the hole, and you get a fishing job.
I mean, the equation on what we potentially save can be very large numbers.
Oh, huge numbers.
So what I like about the business is that, though we're digital, but to this point in time, nobody's really taken that digital information and made it useful to our customers. So we've tried to take a look at it from a very raw standpoint, say, well, what would our customers want from us? And we're early in the stage, but as we go down the path and build these partnerships with our customers, we'll be able to provide them analytics on their wells that we've been to multiple times, and be able to give them some analysis of their failure rates, or are things failing at a certain point? Is there a dog leg in the well that's causing a wear point, or things like that, that I think they would hire an analyst to do with the reports that we give them. But we're trying to find ways to use technology and make a difference that's not going to cost us, you know, a prohibitive amount where our rates are out of line. So we've developed a dispatching app that we're still in the process of fielding, but it gives our customer the ability to have an Uber type experience where they can go on, they can log in. It's preloaded with their set of wells. They can pick the well, tell us a time and date that they want us out there, and it triggers an interactive environment where we dispatch a truck to go do their work. Those are the kind of things that I think, you know, maybe it's not needed, but at least it creates a situation where there's a conversation. They say, well, maybe this is a good idea, or we can tweak it to do something slightly different. The taking advantage of the data we already collect and provide some smarter information from it, I think, is a really good way to look at things. And I think there's some investments we can make in the equipment that we run that improve the safety on the work site, that allow for more consistency of the inspections, as well as reduce the potential hazard of maybe a problem on the well.
That's awesome. And I think that it speaks to one of your earlier comments about when you identify the type of business that you want to create, you know, you look at first, is there a need? And then the second thing you mentioned was differentiating yourself. And those are ways that you're doing that, using data that's already being collected and just presenting it in a way that's useful. And then the Uber concept is very cool. It's something that, you know, maybe they look at it and go, well, this is completely not necessary. But at the same time, I would look at it and go, wow, that is so cool. Like, that I can just order a testing truck out to location on my phone. That's fantastic. Yeah. So I think those are really, really, that's a useful way to differentiate yourself without, like you said, creating an undue financial burden on your side, so you're able to keep your rates and stuff in line with what's industry standard.
Yeah, the key is, like, how do you create value with the investment that you make, you know, because you really have to be conscious of that. You can't go out and field a, let's say, a truck that's three times the cost of the trucks that are going out in the field today and think that you can get something for that if you don't have a way to deliver an increased value for the customer. And so you don't, I guess the moral to that story is, you don't invest in technology just for technology's sake. You want to do it to see a return in the business, whether that's for you or for your customer or both. You know, we've always, in the recent businesses, we had a vision of being paperless. You know, it sounds really good, seems like you're able to do that, but until recently, there hasn't been a lot of solutions you can go grab. And Rally Point's the first one where we've had a chance to stay paperless from the time we initiate the job all the way through invoice and payment. And it seems like a small thing, but we had to continually look for software solutions, and there are some out there now that make a digital ticket. and then convince our customer that it's okay to sign a tablet or a phone and not a piece of paper. Those seem fundamental, but they're hurdles to clear to achieve that objective that you want to get to. So that for us has been an interesting thing, because we started with it on day one with that vision, and we probably paid more than we should out of the block to have that solution. But as we grow, it'll be so much easier to manage that whole process that we don't have to have all the people to manage tickets and process invoices and do the little things that you gain advantage through by using technology.
Yeah, and I think that's an important point, not because I'm guilty of purchasing the latest greatest widget just because it's shinier.
Cool, yeah.
And I'm like, look at that, I need that thing in my life. And then I'm like, man, I never use that at all.
But in our conversation yesterday, you found ways to use existing tools to improve the process.
Sure.
And you know, I think that's the mentality you have to have along the way. You can't accept the way it was always done concept and think that there's not some way that you can improve upon it. And it takes someone with fresh perspective, or even a lot of times someone that's not in the process, to look at it and say, hey, why aren't you doing this or this? This seems to be where things are jamming up and you're not going forward. And there's a solution for that. There's an answer for that.
Right. Yeah, anytime you can use an existing thing, I always am like, hey, we're already paying for that. Why don't we do it a different way? So, yeah, no, that makes sense. Well, thank you so much for coming and sitting down with me. If people want to learn more about RallyPoint, where can they find information on it?
We are on the internet at rp-energy.com. We also have an Instagram handle that is...
I'll have to tell you a funny story about that.
Rally_point energy.
I don't know what it is, but what's funny, you and I had a conversation yesterday. I hadn't posted anywhere that you and I were going to do an interview or anything like that. And I sit down, I open up my Instagram, and it suggested Rally Point for me. I'm like, what the
hell? Someone's listening.
Yeah, for sure. There was. I was like, well, that's interesting. And follow. So yeah. you picked up at least one yesterday.
Yeah, and we're on LinkedIn as well. So, you know, I think the social media platforms, as you know, are really becoming growingly important. And, you know, for businesses especially, LinkedIn seems to be an incredible place to connect. That's how we got connected.
Right.
And, you know, I look to that and try to maintain a business profile there and, you know, other profiles separately. But
under aliases and whatnot.
And my daughter and son have also told me the value of, you know, being present in social media. It's a little generational, but if there's a Instagram page or LinkedIn page they can go to, sometimes that's better than a website nowadays.
So. And I find that I don't go to websites as much as I do go to social media. So that's a great point. And you know, it's funny. I'm a little hesitant at times to post things on social media, not for any other reason than it's just like I don't want people to think I'm a dork, and I'm afraid I might have reached the age where I've lost touch with what dorky is.
I have a dork
is,
filter in my kids. Yeah, that kind of
Well, so I do too. There have been a couple times I posted something, and my 16-year-old will come in and go, "Hey, go ahead and take that down." And I was like, "Oh, you sure?" Because I really feel good about it. Like, no, take that one down. But man, I can't wait to keep up with Rally Point, see how it goes. I know it's going to go great. You have a great track record to draw from. And again, thank you so much for being a part of the
my pleasure. Thank
part
you
of the
for
show.
Having me.
And I can't wait to see what military name you come up with for.
Well, this might be it. You never know.
I doubt it. Based on the conversation, I could see you wanting to do some more things. But man, thank you. And if there's ever anything that I can do for you, please don't hesitate to ask.
Yeah, likewise. I think this has been a great session, a great opportunity, and love the chance to get out and promote the industry as much as we can.
Yeah, absolutely. Needs it.
It does, definitely.
So I really appreciate it.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Have a good one.